disaster. Don't you give up, don't you let away. Talking about a forever after. Don't you give up, don't you dare give in. Don't you give up, don't you dare.
Greetings to all our loyal listeners. This is Jack Tuckner and Deborah Orell with you. And you're joining us today for the Women's Rights in the Workplace Hour. We will be speaking with you for the next hour. And for the rest of this month, did you know that it was Women's History Month for the month of March? So each Monday at 5 p.m., and of course you could tune in at any time at your convenience or at prn.fm to hear us talk with our guests and discussing major issues of the day, mostly that affect women and work, women in the workplace. So let's get started. How are you, Deborah?
Fantastic. And you?
Oh, just outstanding, but I'll get better. Thanks very much. So today, well, first of all, I want to talk, as it's the first day, at least for our show. Oh, and let me tell you, if anyone wants to call in, dial 1-888-874-4888. Again, that's 888-874-4888 with any questions or comments. And anytime you call, we'll be happy to stop everything and take your call and do the best that we can to answer the question or entertain the comment. In 2013, just last year, our nation marked the 165th anniversary of the Seneca Falls Convention. How many of us know what that was? Well, that was the first women's rights convention that addressed women's issues, social, economic, political concerns for women of the day. The declaration, it was called the Declaration of Sentiments and Resolutions at the convention, recognized the potential of women's contributions to our nation. And these women in the first convention to demand women's rights were demanding that women be granted all the rights and privileges that men possessed. Well, good luck with that, because even as of today, 165 years later, women are still struggling for those very same rights, in that the Equal Rights Amendment, which we'll talk about in a little while, has yet to be passed. Corporations may be persons under the Constitution, but women, sadly, are not.
Right. And it still keeps being proposed every single session.
Right. And every single session, what happens? It doesn't pass.
Exactly.
And of course,
it doesn't even get brought for a vote necessarily.
Exactly. It's in the House of Representatives.
Right.
So while American women have certainly made great strides since that historic gathering 165 years ago, I mean, it was, you know, let's face it, it was back then women still didn't have the right to vote. And that didn't happen until what year, Deb? 1920.
The amendment
something,
was 1919 or 1920.
Okay.
1920.
So, what are our problems today still that are facing women with respect to economic issues, women in work? First of all, pay. Okay, 50 years after President John F. Kennedy signed the Equal Pay Act into law, women continue to earn less than men. This is across the board. This is from blue-collar workers, minimum wage type workers, all the way up into the professional classes. Women earn only 70 cents for every dollar earned by men, amounting to a yearly gap of over $11,000 between full-time men and women. That $11,084 loss could purchase 89 more weeks of food, or more than 3,000 additional gallons of gas, or more than 1 year of rent for a woman's family. For women of color and Latinas, the pay gap is even greater. Mm. African-American women, on average, earn only 64 cents to each dollar a white male earns. And Latinas, on average, earn only 55 cents for every dollar earned by white, non-Hispanic men. The minimum wage is a women's issue because nearly two-thirds of minimum wage workers
are women.
Bingo. Yet, the minimum wage has not kept up, as we all know, with inflation over the last 45 years. With the minimum wage now, in inflation-adjusted terms, is more than 30% lower than it was in 1968. If it had been adjusted for inflation today, the minimum wage would be around $22
right.
an hour.
And then it's actually even higher, I believe, if you factor in productivity, because we've become so much more productive. So it's not just dollar to dollar, but then when you factor in the productivity.
Exactly.
I think I saw something that said it would have been like $30 or $40 an hour in comparison.
Okay. In comparison to what it was pre-technology and pre-productivity issues. So what are the solutions? Well, first of all, the Paycheck Fairness Act, and we'll talk about that probably another show, but there's another law, piece of legislation that never passes. And while the Equal Pay Act did a lot to move the arrow, to move the, you know, the dial a little further towards economic justice for women, for many reasons it still doesn't do enough. And it's sadly and regrettably that's clear from the numbers that I just reported that are still the same as they were for decades. Increase the minimum wage, including for tipped workers. That's very important because tipped workers are...
Yeah. You know, that's an interesting thing to talk about that a lot of people aren't aware of.
Mm-hmm.
What that wait unit, you know, waiter, mm-hmm. actually is paid. And I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but it's something like...
Two and change an hour.
Yeah, two and change. But employers are supposed to make sure that they're being paid at least the $7.25.
Correct.
So when they do their own accounting, they make it $7.25, assuming that they've made tips every. They've made at least $5 an hour in tips,
exactly.
And oftentimes they don't. And even if they did, those tips get paid out so that the employer. And management is often included in that tip out.
Right.
So that the, and what's the big fast food breakfast? Denny's, I think, is one of the ones that this came up about.
Mm-hmm.
About, you know, they say I'm making minimum wage, but I'm working and I'm making far less than minimum wage by
right.
the time. But they give me a W-2 or a 1099 that says I actually made more than I did.
Exactly. And there's a lot. We'll also probably deal with that in a show unto itself because just the kickbacks alone in the restaurant industry. I mean, this is an industry, by the way, not only are they paying folks minimum wage or less, again, not really a living wage, but there's no paid sick time. So we should all know that when we go out to eat in restaurants, anyone, our waiter, the cook, the chef in the kitchen, has come to work when they're ill because they don't really have a choice if they need to get paid or want to get paid and have to pay their own bills. And so while they're sneezing in the kitchen on your food, blame the restaurant association, you know, blame the Chamber of Commerce. Again, this is a workers' rights issue. Why do we not have, we're the only country in the industrialized world that does not provide paid sick time as a right of citizenship to those of us who work. And, of course, the right to a job should be a right of citizenship, too, but we'll address that in another show.
And while we're just talking about what else we don't do, out of 178 countries, paid maternity leave.
Well, exactly.
And not to scoff, because, you know, money is money, but disability payments of $172 or $168, it's something like that.
$173 in New York.
Okay, $173 is barely enough to buy food,
right.
Let alone live on.
Right.
So when they talk about it as being, oh, you know, you can collect 6 weeks of disability when you have your baby,
mm-hmm.
that doesn't even pay for the diapers.
Exactly. Well, you mentioned while we're talking about, you know, parental leave and maternity leave. Again, remember, this country, the beacon, the United States of America, you know, certainly the most powerful country in the world, we are in dead last place when it comes to paid parental leave. And just taking a smattering of some of the other countries, and how many people would be aware of this, that in Brazil, for example, a working woman who is pregnant and leaves the job to have her baby for her maternity leave, she is paid her full pay for 120 days for her maternity leave. Canada, she receives 55% of her pay for 119 days. China, 3 months, 100% of her pay. China, this is right in a totalitarian country, talking about scoffing at a communist totalitarian country, you know, at least nominally, 100% of a woman's pay for 3 months. France, 100% of her pay for 112 days. Germany, 100% of her pay for 98 days. India, 100% of a woman's pay for 84 days of maternity leave. Indonesia, 100% of a woman's pay for 84 days. Italy, 80% of pay for 140 days. Japan, 60% of pay for 98 days. The Netherlands, 112 days at 100% of pay. Russia, 100% of pay for 140 days. Saudi Arabia, 50% of pay for 70 days. And the list goes on and on. Spain, 100% of pay. Switzerland, 80%. Turkey, 67%. The England, 90% of pay for 280 days. Australia, a flat rate for 126 days. What is the rate in the United States? Anyone? Anyone? Right. Zero. Zero paid maternity leave. Zero. None of it is paid. And in fact, it's only guaranteed unpaid leave for 12 weeks if one is lucky enough to work for a company that has at least 50 employees, and at least half the workforce does not. And another condition is the pregnant employee has to have worked at that company for at least one full year at full-time employment prior to the birth of her baby. So it really doesn't leaves a lot of women, you know, up a creek without a paddle when it's time to have their baby. So in terms of, you know, a culture that pretends to talk about family values, we really don't walk that talk at all.
At all.
And so, you know, when we're talking about pregnancy issues, the Pregnancy Discrimination Act, which is another significant, issue that prior to 35 years ago, 36 years ago and beyond, when a working woman became pregnant, she had no job protection. If the employer, and often employers did, feel that she was now in a diminished state because she was, you know, her utility is diminished for many reasons. She needs to go visit her doctor. She needs to have sonograms. She needs amnios. She's going to visit the lavatory more frequently. She may not be able to work those crazy long hours. She has to take a number of meal breaks.
And or the accommodation for maybe I can't lift 50 pounds anymore. I can
exactly.
Only...
We don't have any... You know that New York City this year passed... This past year in 2013 passed the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, right? Mm-hmm. Which allows, just what Deborah said, if you're, for instance, a cashier, just to pick one random job, and you stand on your feet for a 7-hour shift, and you're in your second or third trimester, and your OBGYN has said to you, you know what, maybe you really shouldn't stand your feet, or they're swollen, you've got edema, you really should sit. I'm saying that it would be better for you and for your unborn child if you just asked your employer, can you sit? Can they give you a stool while you work? Still be able to be a cashier? You know, throughout this country, that's not a right. Your employer can tell you under federal law that, sorry, we're not giving you a stool. We're not giving you an extra break. We're not doing anything to accommodate you. Why? Because it's not required. Why? Because pregnancy is not a disability under federal law. Well, yes, there are other ways potentially around it if they're treating you differently because of your gender, and maybe perhaps we'll get to that with a real case study, you know, on another show. But the point is that there is no right to an accommodation for flexibility, for compassion, for any adjustment of your schedule if you've got limitations related to your pregnancy. And again, we stand alone as a nation with that type of inflexibility and sort of corporate-minded, bottom-line, profitocracy kind of stuff that will say, too bad, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen, sister. You can't do the job fully. This is your job. You got to stand 8 hours. You can't do it, come back when you're able to after you have this baby and you take your maternity leave. And of course, at that point, their job is not available. New York has just changed that. There are a handful of municipalities that have said, you know what, if an employee says, I need to sit, I need to go see my doctor, I need a couple of days off, I have morning sickness, I need to come in an hour later and maybe leave an hour later so I don't hit rush hour traffic in the subways, New York City now requires that an employer accommodate that employee. And it's just right. It seems only civilized. It seems only the right thing to do for most of us who know a woman that we love, our sisters, our daughters, our wives, our mothers. How about ourselves? More than half the population, female. How is it that the United States and most jurisdictions, including the state of New York still. If you don't work in the city and you work for the state, you're not entitled to that type of accommodation. It's really outrageous. You know, so it was the Pregnancy Discrimination Act of 1978, which again is only 35 years old, this year 36 years old. Prior to that, there was absolutely no protection. Sex, as it is mentioned in the Civil Rights Act, the protecting individual employees because of who they are as women, did not extend to pregnancy, which is clearly a female issue. And now, as of 1978, at least, while it doesn't effectively deal with what I just talked about in terms of accommodating pregnant women, which is a big deal and a big problem, the Pregnancy Discrimination Act still protects women from being fired or not hired or otherwise treated badly as a result of their pregnancy. So if you feel that you're being treated differently at work after you notify your employer that you're pregnant, during the course of your pregnancy, during the 9 months that you're at work, if there is backlash, and this happens more and more. We just read a study today. I might be able to pull it up here in a second. That will be coming out in June in the Gender and Society Journal.
The Ohio thing?
No, it was the, let's see where it is. It was a new study.
Southwestern University in Texas.
Yes.
A professor at Ohio State
Thank
University.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes, this new study will be published in the June 2014 issue of Gender and Society, is a major investigation into the phony justifications that employers who discriminated against pregnant workers gave to employees before firing them. The two professors from two different universities examined 85 confirmed cases of pregnancy discrimination processed by the Civil Rights Commission for most years from 1986 to 2011. And they found that pregnancy accounted for 40%, almost half, of gender-related terminations. And around in half of these cases, let's see if I have it in front of me still, employers told the pregnant women, in roughly 30% of these cases, the employers told the pregnant women that they were being fired for performing poorly, and another 15% they were told that they were let go for tardiness. Of course, and what do you think? A closer look at their workplaces found that pregnant employees were placed under greater scrutiny than their non-pregnant coworkers. Many pregnant women in these professor's samples identified other non-pregnant workers in the workplaces who had more absences, less seniority, lower job performance, or more infractions or tardiness, but were not sanctioned or pushed out.
This speaks to the whole gender issue in our society in terms of women being paid less, treated differently, not only as pregnant women, but just as women. And when you factor in, I also just read David Yamada is a professor with somewhere, but he writes this blog on bullying, workplace bullying. Mm-hmm. 70% of the bullies in the office are men. Women bully, but only 30% of the time. So the majority, so there is this inherent in our laws, in our society, in our culture of this, what's the word? That this hostility toward women.
Right. Almost inexplicable.
And what is this? Yeah. And it is. It's inexplicable.
Might not be inexplicable, Jim, when you look into sort of why the sexism and misogyny is so ingrained in the fabric of our culture. But what we're talking about is, like, again, how do you account for just generally that as I mentioned earlier, we all probably are fond of a woman in our life. It's just, why is it that we're willing to sort of second-class citizenship them? Why is it that we're willing to, you know, there's that sort of sense of, you know, how does this happen? Would men put up for it? Would men
No.
put up with it?
World War I, when women really entered the workforce, and I think, I forget what the numbers are, but there were 2 million, and then, you know, there were 6 million women working in the country. Men who had the job in the factory were paid X. Women were paid minus X. The war ends, and this is World War I. So women are doing the same exact job.
Right.
But now the men come back, so of course women have to be fired because the men.
Right.
And And they called it the family wage, because men, of course, have to take care of families. Right. Now, for 4 or 5 years, women had been working to take care of the family, but they were paid less. They get fired so that men can get the job back, and if the wage goes right back up.
Right. Of course.
It's insane.
Right. Of
course. It's just...
Let's see what our studio audience thinks of that. Okay. Well, I just wanted to go through...
You know, it makes you want to just say, why don't women go on strike?
Well, that's perhaps something that... You know,
seriously.
Start here with our voluminous.
Yeah, I think
audience.
We should plan a day where women, as a whole, just go on strike. If you don't, you know, it's so that somebody will recognize the importance, the value, the weight of women. Women, I don't think recognize.
Well, that might be the point.
Okay.
Right.
Because that is the other part of what I see.
Right.
Reluctance, we're acculturated to go along, to just,
get
and
along.
It start,
yeah.
Go along to get along. It starts early.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, the comments, the asides, we're
right.
always trying to be liked, to like, to take
right.
care. You know, it's how we're acculturated to
right.
a degree,
mm-hmm.
yet we feel... Well, if I do all this for you, you're going to do it for me.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't work that
way. And it
way.
Doesn't work that way.
Right, right. Well, that's beyond our ability to change that, you know, today. But it is sort of fascinating. And again, just equally fascinating is, you know, back to the Equal Rights Amendment. You know, I don't know how many of our, you know, younger listeners know that the Equal Rights Amendment, okay, which was affirmed, the notion was when it was written to affirm the equal application of the Constitution to everyone, regardless of their sex. Meaning that the idea of the Equal Rights Amendment, which was written in 1923
right.
by Alice Paul, who was a suffragist leader and founder of the National Women's Party, after a women's right vote was guaranteed by the 19th Amendment in 1920... She, Alice Paul, proposed the Equal Rights Amendment as the next step in confirming equal justice under the law for all citizens. Which citizens were missing in this equal application of the law? Women. Women. You know,
women aren't mentioned in the Constitution anywhere. That was the point.
Right. Well, but neither are corporations. And what's interesting is corporations...
That's true.
Corporations now, as of 2010, in the latest of obscene decision from our highest court... found and held that corporations are persons under the Constitution, and money is speech. And corporations, through the 14th Amendment, are protected by the Constitution. Yet women don't have the same actual protections now sort of embodied in the law the way that corporations are through this landmark decision the Supreme Court handed down in January of 2010, called Citizens United versus Federal Election Committee, an absolute, you know, abortion of a decision, to use a perhaps inapt phrase. But the ERA was introduced into Congress every year from 1923 to 1972 when it was passed and then sent to the states for ratification. But it never passed. It had up to 35 states, three short of the 38 required to put it into the Constitution. And then the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment, guaranteeing women equality under the law, has been introduced into every Congress since 1982, beginning in 1994 with the introduction of the first three-state strategy bill in Congress. ERA advocates have been pursuing different strategies, none of them successful.
Right. They're just trying to get three more states on board. First, they had to get that strategy approved, that if we could just get three more states to say yes, then it would pass. Which is what the insane part is, that there's any state
right.
that doesn't want
right.
to say
right.
yes to
right.
this.
Right. But it's, of course, also insane that any state or congressperson doesn't want to say yes to increasing our minimum wage from $7.25
oh, well,
an hour.
Again, how about the LGBT decision that they, the how many senators voted to
right.
continue allowing discrimination?
Right. Well, certainly every Republican senator.
Well, they were all Republicans, but they weren't all of the Republicans.
Right. Well, they were. That's right. There were 32 Republicans that voted no. But perhaps we'll get to that in another time. But just, you know, again, I was looking at, you know, the list of problems still, just in terms of gender issues, mostly around the workplace and economic issues. We're talking about workers in 145 countries around the world. I mentioned earlier sick pay that we don't have. Workers in 145 countries have earned paid sick days, but there is no policy to ensure earned sick days in the United States. 145 countries, we're the only one that does not. The United States has no mandatory paid family leave policy, making it one of just three countries in the world. Was this what I mentioned before? Yeah. Well, three countries in the world, it's the same as paid maternity leave, that does not mandate paid sick time. Okay, more than 40 million private sector workers in this country, including more than 13 million working women. Okay, more than 13 million working women are not able to take a paid sick day when they or their family member or child are ill. Millions more lack paid sick time to care for a sick child. Nearly a quarter of adults in the U.S., that's 23% of adults, report that they have lost a job or have been threatened with job loss for taking time off due to illness or to care for a sick child or relative. And how outrageous
is
that?
Well, that's the whole bankruptcy thing, too. The 60, 70%, 80%, I mean, it's a huge number of bankruptcies are because of medical costs.
Right. Well, that's another issue.
Right. I know, but I'm just throwing that in there on the health, we are not necessarily, or we certainly don't act like a country that values family, but we also don't value health either.
Right. Well, we're a country that values profit. Corporations.
That's it.
Which is why, again, we're the only country in all of the industrialized world and all of the OECD countries, the modern first world countries, so to speak, although we're fast becoming a third world country ourselves, but we're the only one that does not again have any kind of paid maternity leave or any paid sick leave. Oh, I'm sorry. And that requires us to pay bankers, which are health insurance companies, to skim a third off the top so that we can have health care. What do they do to provide health care? Why don't we take the money that we spend for our so-called insurance and pay it right to our doctors and nurses? What do you think, listeners? Would it be better, instead of spending that $1,000 a month on your private insurer, to keep that money for your own health care, however you deem it should be spent, to keep yourself healthy emotionally, physically, spiritually? So, you know, that is just another reason that right now in our country, corporations, the bottom line, are who makes a profit. And it certainly has nothing to do with our health or our well-being or the commons or, you know, the general welfare of those of us in this country. So how would we fix this problem? We're talking about paid sick leave anyway. We should have paid sick leave. We all call our congressperson and demand paid sick leave. Eventually, this is the only way this is going to work, with real grassroots initiative, not the AstroTurf kind of phony, you know, grassroots kind of thing, such as, you know, the Tea Party that's basically just funded by billionaires and large corporations or billionaires like the Koch brothers, but real grassroots. The thing that does make a difference, just like the Occupy Wall Street movement, and sort of now, if you check out 99rise.org, which is another offshoot where, you know, the activism that will make, that's what moved President Obama, the times that he does, you know, move in a progressive direction to talk about legislation, and for our Congress folk to talk about legislation that is in their constituents' best interest.
Okay, and so to that point, our Congress people, the majority of which are congressmen, not Congress people.
Yes.
So one of the big issues is if the Senate, regardless of Republican, Democrat, regardless of party line, if it truly was 50 women and 50 men,
right?
Don't you believe, don't you know for certain that priorities would shift immediately? Think of the House of Representatives even.
Right.
If half of the people, even 40%, were women tend to have different priorities.
Right.
And so therefore would vote.
Right.
The agenda would change.
It would.
So one of the other ways is not just to, you know, vote, which is something I say to everybody who calls the office when they complain. Are you mean to tell me that what happened to me is legal? Sadly, yes. So pay attention to who you vote for. But to try and figure out, like Yale's Campaign School for Women, Pennsylvania, Penn State, I think it is, has a campaign school like that. How to get more women interested in the political process, and to get more women to run campaigns and run for office, get involved.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And certainly a critical mass of women, more women, in holding elective office would be a huge step in the right direction, as long as, again, there's more women, and most of them are not Michelle Bachmann, which would be the presumption, if you just get more women, that they're not going to be, you know, reactionaries that are still towing the...
Okay, but you'll always have the Michelle Bachmanns, just like you'll always have, you know, male counterparts to that.
Right.
But that's the point. You'll also have the female Bernie Sanders.
Right. Exactly. Or the Elizabeth Warrens. That's what we need. More Elizabeth Warrens and Bernie Sanders. So
love Bernie.
We love Bernie Sanders on the Women's Rights in the Workplace show. Bernie Sanders for president. And the world would be, again, you know, this isn't the world. The country would be a better place, a fairer place. All the boats would rise. I mean, it's just so clear. What progressives like Bernie Sanders and the Progressive Caucus in Congress stand for is investing in ourselves, not investing in corporations that will or have closed 100,000 factories. 100,000 factories, 100,000 factories. That's not jobs. That's 100,000 factories employing up to hundreds of people have closed in the last 13 years, 14 years now, since George W. Bush was first elected till today, 100,000 factories and hundreds of thousands of jobs have been moved where? To overseas, to countries where the minimum wage is, in Vietnam, the minimum wage is 26 cents a day. So corporations, you know, can make massive profits, and then what do?
Like Apple Computer.
Like Apple Computer, like GE just moved its medical device, you know, the one of their very expensive factories, and I believe it was in Minnesota, that makes MRIs and machines like that. They moved that also to some other country away from here, where they can sit on their cash and stash it in the Cayman Islands and in Swiss banks, and not pay their fair share of taxes, and just hollowing out this entire country, that there's nothing, there is no middle class left. We have, you know, the top 1%, the top 0.1% in this country have taken in 95% of the new income in these last 10 years as well. Union membership's down 30%. We're really going back to a time that I don't think we want to be in, before the New Deal, before LBJ's Great Society. You know, the New Deal, FDR was a great president, and we all forget this because none of us really were alive. Most of us weren't. But, you know, FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in his inaugural address, I believe in 1946, spoke about this for the 12 years he was in office, a second Bill of Rights. It's called the Second Bill of Rights.
Right.
And basically what he talked about is what any civilized nation, the United States, should be is a place where a job is a right of citizenship. If the private sector can't, if Halliburton can't provide it, if Walmart can't provide it, then the government steps in. And you know what? We all know that there's plenty to be done. I mean, our rail beds are falling apart, our dams, our public transportation, our bridges, everything is a mess. Hasn't been... You know, we haven't upgraded in decades. We could have a new public works project where we put everyone to work. What that means, we're investing in ourselves. Then guess what happens? There is more money circulating, more demand. Anyone who's really studied economics 101 knows that it's not the job creators, the nonsense that they try to sell us, this whole supply side nonsense, which, you know, the whole Reaganomics, which is just a line of, you know, it's just a joke. It's demand that creates an economy's rise. It's demand, and it's having, you know, people that have the average worker that spends money, that pays taxes. We have to get more money into our coffers. It's not about austerity. In the history of this planet, austerity which everyone is trying now. We're, you know, talking about balancing the budgets on the backs of the working class and the poor, like we're doing here. Let's get rid of food stamps so that hungry people, so that kids, where now one out of five children in this country lives with food insecurity. You know that, Deborah?
Yes.
One out of five.
Yes.
Food insecurity. What does that mean? Hunger. They go to sleep hungry in the United States of America. And instead, we're still giving huge welfare subsidies to big oil and big coal and agriculture and, you know, and 25% of American corporations pay no taxes at all. And you've got people like Mitt Romney who are paying less. Their marginal effective tax rate is 13%, which is probably half of what yours is if you're a middle class person. So we're really, you know, what we have to do is get, of course, money out of politics, where we now have, you know, 37,000 lobbyists in D.C. Before Reagan, there were 300. 37,000 highly paid lobbyists, starting salary, $350,000 a year. Up to $2 million a year for those who come out of Congress. That's what they do. They leave Congress, they become lobbyists for the companies, for companies that now want them, paying
that
them.
That want access.
That want access, exactly. As Tom Hartman says, our congressmen should wear NASCAR badges on their, you know, to sit there when they're in the Senate or the House of Representatives to show us who pulls their strings.
Who's sponsoring them.
Who's sponsoring them, because that's what
right.
It's all about. When John Boehner was handing out tobacco money on the floor of, at the time, the House of Representatives, he was handing out checks to basically buy votes for R.J. Reynolds and the big tobacco company. So it really is something we have to take back. This is all about, you know, in fact, visit movetoamend.org. What we need is a constitutional amendment to take money out of politics. And it's all important that we all get involved in this. I mean, you know, again, this is we're all kind of going to heck in a handcart. This isn't just an issue. You know, most of us are kind of apathetic and we're too busy.
Well, you know, it's not that we're apathetic or too busy. It's so overwhelming. I know for myself, I probably read, you know, 50 blogs, 50 newsletters. I follow a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But what can you really do? You know, you got to pick your target. It's
right.
Just that it's so overwhelming, and it's just trying to figure out what
right.
difference can I really make.
Right. But many of us don't really know, because really the corporate media doesn't really tell us.
Exactly.
And why is that? Because the corporate media, which is, you know, they used to be 5,500 radio stations in this
right.
country. Now there are six.
Right.
You know, we have so much concentrated power. There's no one in the corporate media that isn't a wealthy person, and they work for Comcast and Time Warner.
Except for the internet, where it's not so concentrated, and that's why they're trying to take away net neutrality,
right.
because the corporations want to control that too.
Right. Well, that's another, you know, that is
another issue. I
well,
know.
It's and it's another issue that most of us are really unaware of. They're
yeah.
not talking about that on the 11 o'clock news. That a recent decision, which effectively killed what has been called net neutrality, which is it's like our nation's highways. You know that no matter how much right now you use the internet, it is the same. You'll pay the same monthly price for how much and where you go and what you download. It's the same price when you pay, you know, Time Warner or whomever you pay. But now that if Comcast is allowed to buy Time Warner, which is what has been going on, you've got this concentration of power. If Comcast decides, you know what, you want access to certain stations, you want access to certain, you know, liberal media, or you want to do something that we don't think is, you know, appropriate or that is in our best interest as a corporation, we could slow you down, you know. Well,
what they're saying is it's not even so much the content of it, but if you want to pay a higher price, we'll deliver whatever it is you want faster.
Right.
But you have to pay a higher price to
right.
get it.
But that changes. First of all,
yeah.
First of all,
access.
We built the internet. I mean, the internet itself was basically funded by our money, government money, with private business. But it's our internet, and now, of course, corporations are saying, "Yeah, well, you're not
right.
so fast."
Well, so just like the airwaves.
Right.
Right.
So, you know, just back to a couple of the points I wanted to make about, we were just talking about sick leave. So what would a solution be? Have paid sick leave. We should all have paid sick leave, as every union used to insist that every union member in every job had. In fact, many jobs, when I was a young lawyer working in a public defender's office, we had unlimited sick leave. Basically, the notion was, you're sick, we're not counting the days. Get better, come back. That's what a civilized nation should do. Paid family and medical leave. Right, if for everyone, and despite the relationship that you have to, it could be your whomever, your partner, your child, yourself, paid family and medical leave, expanded family and medical leave, because right now, again, it only applies to a small percentage of the workforce. Family and Medical Leave Act, again, applies to only those of us who work for 50, an employer with at least 50 or more employees, and we have to have worked there full-time for at least a year. Talk a little bit about child care. You know, child care for most of us is a necessity these days. Preschool children, why? Because households need two incomes to pay all the bills, bottom line. But while most other industrialized countries have universal preschool for 3 and 4 year olds, there is drastic lack of quality preschool for American children in the U.S.
Right.
What's more, the lack of availability of affordable, high quality child care in this country has reached crisis proportions in many places. In fact, one of the, in here in this city, our new progressive mayor, Bill de Blasio, really ran on, and much to the chagrin and consternation of all New York's many multimillionaires and billionaires who said, I'm not spending $900 a year to put some snot-nosed kid up in preschool, pre-K, because that's what it would cost. Those who earn in New York, and this is still now an up-and-coming trending issue and something that Mayor de Blasio is working very hard to implement, anyone who, in the city who makes earns $500,000 or more would be expected to help fund universal pre-K for all the children in the city. And many children, of course, do not have, from families that don't have the funds to pay for private preschool, which is, of course, again, an economic, it makes sense because it's just contributing to, we end up saving money.
Right.
Right? We save money in the long run with kids who graduate from high school, kids who or don't become delinquent, kids who have a head start in life. Speaking of, you know, head start.
Head start.
Another thing that we're, you know, throwing kids off of head start to try to save money. How myopic, how short-sighted is that? So here in New York City, where it would cost $930, I pay $930. I don't earn $500,000 or more a year, but I pay it so that all kids could have universal pre-K. It just seems so unnecessarily stingy to be fighting something like that. And again, everybody who voted against Bill de Blasio, that was one of the things, at least people I know, that they, you know, stated for a reason for their opposition. He's taking our money. He's a communist. He's a socialist. Well, you know what? This country was founded on, and if you looked at what our founders talked about, it's the general welfare, the commons that make us the
life,
great society
liberty,
we were.
Liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
To all men, it said men, but all
right.
People are created equal and should have that, the access to the pursuit of happiness, right?
Right.
So, when it comes to child care, the U.S. ranks guests 28th out of 38 countries in the share of four-year-olds enrolled in preschool. Now, this is according to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD. Nearly two-thirds of American women with preschool-age children work, yet in the U.S., families are generally left on their own to provide for their own child care. The average cost of full-time child care for one kid, one child in a daycare center in 2011, it ranged from $4,000 to $12,000, depending on the state. So in New York, where it's higher than $12,000, it's just completely daunting and could really, you know, leaves people up, you know, with very few options, especially if you're not making a ton of money. And many of us are no longer have that option and not making the money.
I am only always so grateful that I had my children when I had money so that I could afford to put them in preschool.
Right. Yes. Yes. Well, and how long ago was that, Deborah?
Long time.
Okay.
Long time.
Okay. I got you. We'll stay away from those subjects. So, and you know, there are some solutions that we've jotted down here. President Obama's preschool and early Head Start child care initiative. Again, fat chance of that passing. Promote affordable and high-quality child care. Adequate funding of child care programs. Expand child care tax credit. Make child tax credit permanent and indexed. And increase access to child support. I mean, you know, there are so many things we can do that we don't bother doing because it doesn't affect those who have the power in this country who already have the means and the resources and the wherewithal to either have someone stay home with the kids or to pay for high-quality daycare. So
this is one of the other issues that primarily affects women,
mm-hmm.
This whole daycare issue.
Which issue? Daycare?
Daycare issue is mm-hmm. primarily women because women, even if, you know, they're in some kind of partnership or marriage, women still are responsible, have the higher percentage of responsibility of taking care of the kids. But for those who are doing it on their own, be they separated, divorced, or just having children without marriage or anything, this also impacts their ability to work, to get a job. We have a couple of clients who, that's part of the problem. They got fired right after they, you know, came back from maternity leave, and now they have this infant. Who's going to take care of this baby so I can go to work?
Right.
And at minimum wage, or even if I'm making $9 an hour, I can't afford rent and daycare, so I can't work.
Right.
And then you have the people calling them, you know, the welfare people, because it's not like they don't want to work. There's, number one, few jobs. But number two, even if they find it,
right,
what do you do with the child?
Right. And when they lose their job, there is, of course, their health care for their baby. So all the women that, for instance, just in our office, we represent, I'd say that most of our women's rights cases turn, or many of them turn, on pregnancy issues.
Yeah.
When a woman loses her job as a result of her pregnancy, because she is out for 3 months and loses her momentum and loses her traction at work, and she's out of sight and out of mind, and that happens, as I just read in this latest study, with far too frequently to be a coincidence, they also lose their health insurance. So they're not taking their child. The pediatrician is not seeing them without insurance. They're not being able to go back to their OBGYN without insurance. If they're on unemployment benefits, they likely now earn too much money to qualify for the Medicaid.
Well, no. Under the Affordable Care Act, it actually is affordable. But when you're working, when you're living such a marginal life,
right?
Even $50, like they're saying, the SNAP program, you know, losing $70 a month toward food, that is a huge percentage. But as far as health care, it's now much better. Like, there are plans, because, you know,
what $50 plan is there? What are we talking about?
Well,
we're talking about hundreds of dollars, aren't we?
Well, but even if it's hundreds of dollars, the actual plan, depending on if they have no money, they would qualify for assistance, so that it might only cost them $50 instead of $350 or $450.
Right. Okay.
So that's where the assistance comes in, because the government will help.
Right. But how many of our clients, especially those who are living in New York, when they lose their job, if they've just had a baby, are able to have disposable income? You know,
there is none.
Okay. So, but they consider, our clients consider it almost an elective item. Health care, right, when it comes down to, I've got to pay my rent, I have to keep the lights on, I have to feed this baby. And, you know, health care, whether it's under the ACA or even under some of our, you know, the low-income programs, unless it's straight-up Medicaid or Medicare for those who qualify or aren't 65 years old in the various programs, it is an amount of money that is not really free for spending, especially when there are still going to be co-pays and other issues.
You know, and I will tell you.
What were you saying, Deborah?
I don't know. I just forgot, because I got so
distracted by me.
Distracted by the break,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Healthcare we were talking about.
Well, you know, one of the things, and it's related, because when we talk also in our discrimination practice, we see a lot of folks that have problems with work as related to their disability. And when it comes to pregnancy, most of the time, issues that relate to pregnancy discrimination also implicate issues of disability, because you cannot work, certainly when you're out on leave, right, when you have a baby, for a certain period of time, you are disabled. When I mentioned earlier in the show that if you're working and you're pregnant and your doctor says you have edema in your ankles and feet and you need to sit down, and I have this slight disability, well, yes, if the disability itself is considered a disability, but your pregnancy isn't a disability during, you know, your gestational period. So if you say, well, you know what, just as a result of my pregnancy, I need a little bit of special attention, I need some special consideration, accommodations, but my only problem is I'm pregnant. I'm not sick, I'm not dying, I'm pregnant. That is not a disability under federal law and under most state laws. Under every law, including federal law, when you have the baby, when your water breaks, you deliver your baby for at least 6 weeks, you're disabled. And that's when you're, at that point, eligible for disability payments. And it's a bit of a protected category because you can't work. Certainly everybody agrees.
Which is why you can't collect unemployment during those 6 weeks.
Exactly.
Because
you can't work.
Because you can't work.
Exactly.
So you can't collect unemployment. So
exactly.
even when you get fired, that pregnant.
Yeah, exactly. But again, back to what we do in this culture, you know, we have a client, I'm thinking of a client right now who has been for 4 months, she has not been able to get an MRI for an issue that she has because no one is paying for it. Okay, it ends up being a workers' comp issue. Workers' comp won't pay for it. She can't use her regular medical insurance. So it becomes, again, you need the MRI. We keep saying to her, how are we going to know? She keeps saying, and her family is saying, how are we going to diagnose, get a proper diagnosis without an MRI? But no one's going to pay for it. The insurance company won't pay for it. The workers' comp folks aren't paying for it. She can't afford to pay for it herself, even if that were an option, but it's not an option. So, you know, we have all kinds of problems related to, you know, our ability to remain gainfully employed. If you have a great job, you know, if you know someone or you work for, you know, a municipal agency and you have some form of like tenure and security and a pension that's stable, consider yourself very lucky, especially if you still have a union and you know you're going to be secure here until the job, until you're ready to retire. Terrific. How many of us are in that position? How many of us know someone?
There is no job security.
Well, for a few people, there's a job security. I mean, if you're a court officer, I think of certain jobs, like in New York. If you're a court officer in New York for 20 years and you're going to do another 10 years, right now you won't lose your job and you know there'll be a pension. Maybe your pension won't be secure is another story in the coming days when we have our next economic crash. But, you know, some people do have a semblance of security in their jobs, but most of us don't. And if you work for a company where you're not protected by a union, and there's about 6% of us now in the private sector, except for, and that excludes postal workers, and they have their own problems because of the poison pill that the Republicans put in a couple of years ago when they're making the post office fund 75 years into the future its pension program for postal workers that haven't yet been born. No other agency has that kind of onerous. They wanted to kill the post office, and they're doing a good job of it. But beside the post office, private sector workers, 6% now have the benefit of union membership.
And unfortunately, many of those unions do not wield the power, the ability to really help when employees have issues. I mean, how many people
right.
call the
That's
office
right. That's right.
who are part of a particular union
right.
and they're being discriminated against, they're being harmed or hurt in some way, and the first question is, have you gone to your union? What have they done? 90-something percent of them say they're not doing anything
right.
because they don't want to lose their job with the employer.
Right. Well, the strength of unions have become so decimated over the years.
It's so sad.
And so, you know, they've lost a lot of their juice. And so where it used to be you could rely on your union to enforce the contract, which is what it's supposed to be about, the collective bargaining agreement, which is a contract that you as a worker are a beneficiary of. And it used to be, back in the day, that unions would fight for its membership. But it's, you know, so watered down, as we all saw, you know, even recently in the, was it Volkswagen? Is that the plant that was in, Senator Bob Corker put the kibosh on, again, the union membership this past week? You know, these so-called right-to-work states, which we call right-to-work-for-less states. It's just in every state where they say, sure, you should be able to work for $3 an hour. You know, remember, there's the Republican Party platform, the GOP platform was in the 2012 election, was the elimination of the minimum wage. There's the elimination of the minimum wage. It's perfectly fine in the name of freedom. Freedom, that if I want to work, you should be free
to
work for $3 an hour.
Right.
You know, you should be free to sleep under a bridge. You should be free. That's liberty.
Right.
You know, that's the sort of Ayn Randian kind of, you know, pure capitalist.
But then again, you should be free to start your own business and have it prosper or fail. But you're not free to do that because the government, the laws, will protect the corporation.
Right.
The business that you're free to start.
Right, right. the big corporation that will eat you out, yes. So that will push you out, and, you know, eat your lunch is what I meant to say.
Yeah.
So we have a couple of minutes left today, and we'll let you know during the week when we through some of our promos what guests we will have coming up for the rest of Women's History Month. We'll have some interesting folks talking about various facets of women's empowerment or women's disempowerment, and we're hoping that we'll get some folks to call in, start an engaging discussion, and perhaps get some people to just maybe make a phone call to their own congressperson. You know what, that's all we could do really, is do the best that we can individually. We all think that, you know what, it won't really count. Well, I'm going to make a phone call to my senator, my congresswoman, they're not really listening. Well, you know what, they do listen.
They do.
It does matter. It matters.
It does.
And so, you know, as long as we sort of educate ourselves and don't just sit there at night and, you know, sort of watch, you know, the corporate media that just tells us if everything is okay, well, the people you're watching, it may be okay for them. It's really not okay for most of us. And we really all have to get involved, because most of these issues, you know, 99% of us, I mean, literally, it's not just, you know, the 1%. 99% of us in this country right now are suffering and struggling. And, you know, even just issues that we don't deal with in terms of climate change, and that would also provide for jobs, economic stimulus, if we just woke up and smelled the coffee,
right,
so to speak, and we started investing in renewable energy sources instead of just funding big oil, you know, and the big
and clean coal.
Yeah, clean coal, right. Fracking, yeah, baby, in my neighborhood. So, you know, that is where we are for today. And
just, you know, on the pregnancy, for more information, again, information is power. So what if knowing what to do if these things happen to you is important. So womensrightsny.com for a free download of the Women's Rights in the Workplace, a guide to pregnancy discrimination. It's free on there. Everything you need to know and do to protect yourself.
Terrific. Thank you, Deborah. This is Jack Tuckner and Deborah O'Rell with Tuckner, Sipser, Weinstock & Sipser, the Women's Rights and the Workplace Advocates. And we were privileged to be with you today, and we'll see you next Monday, Eastern Time at 5 p.m. Have a great week.